Hi, Matthew.
How you doing, Jackie?
This is a tough time of year. The holidays, December, Christmas. I don't know when the last time was you watched actually The Year Without a Santa Claus. I bet
Exactly.
it's been maybe since for you the 1970s. Is that right?
I'll tell you, go on. I'm going to have to defer to
Well,
you on this one.
apropos of the UN, we had sort of a 1970s childhood, right? And so all those Christmas shows, they're all on now on reruns. And of course, I'm terribly nostalgic about them
Oh, I
all.
see.
My kids watch them
Sure.
and they kind of get bored after a little while. And I'm like, wait, it's Heat Miser. Come back, come
Right.
back.
Oh no,
But
now I got what you're saying. Sure.
so now, anyway, there was this, apropos of the UN, there's this scene in The Year Without a Santa Claus where Santa realizes that all the children of the world really do appreciate and want him. And so there's this hysterical scene of all the children in the world dressed in their national costumes, embracing Christmas and Santa Claus. So it explains a lot. It explains how it's possible to grow up and pretty much assume that everyone out there is celebrating Christmas with you.
Right. That's a
It
good.
explains a lot of cultural chauvinism that we've had to become adults to understand. So,
No,
anyway.
that's I'll give you, I mean, just as the UN always tries to, they do give a UN holiday for Thanksgiving, which are, I guess it's since it's based in
Well,
New
host
York,
country, right,
it's
yeah.
based in New York, you have to. But then they gave the Friday. They had another theory. There was a Muslim holiday. They slipped in there for Friday. It seemed pretty convenient in terms of people's 4-day weekend, but they wanted
Absolutely.
to make sure that they weren't giving in all the way to the host country,
All right. Well, getting right down to business, I thought we ought to start by talking about your huge fame in the UN because there was recently a UN correspondence dinner, I understand, and you featured prominently in it. Do you
It was
want
a little
to?
weird. I think it's that they didn't, and I, you know. There are bigger topics we're going to come to, much
Yeah.
bigger. This was sort of, I think it's all, the way I'll try to put it in a bigger context is that this is definitely the end of an era at the UN. Like this was every year, at least since I've been here, but long before it, they've done this UN Correspondents Association dinner in the big like UN dining room over the river. Now this whole building, I mean, behind me, there's actually some boxes we're packing up, but the building's more than half empty and they're moving everybody out. So this was sort of a, and so they do this thing. They have a dinner. Ban Ki-moon gave a speech. His new spokesman gave a speech. Richard Roth of CNN was like the MC. It was a black tie affair. I don't really have a tuxedo, so I wore a suit. But I don't really. I think it's just a matter of kind of like new media because as it like in the afternoon before it, I got a call from the Ban Ki-moon speechwriter saying, "Do you mind if he mentions you in the speech?" Which is a little weird because they often like cut me off from asking questions. And anyway, so I was like, "Go ahead." And he made this joke that he said, he has a new spokesman now. This is Ban Ki-moon. He gave a speech. He said he has a new spokesman now, but the person he really wanted to apply for it, wanted to be a spokesman, didn't even apply. And then they flashed my picture, and people laughed. I think the idea is that it's a joke that he wouldn't want me as a spokesman, but it is. And then the new spokesman actually, this was kind of an off-color joke. He said he's come in from Austria, where he was his name is Martin Nesserke, where he was the spokesman for the OSCE, and he's brought with him Mozart's golden balls, and he will award them to me, which people thought was a little strange. But I think it's because things got very. I try not to be rude, but and again, I want to. I think it's more has to do with new media versus old media. Like most print journalists here, at most their publication is going to let them write like one story,
Right.
Whereas like with online journalism, you can write five or six a day. So I'll like ask about Nepal, the Congo, so anyway, that was the and the final joke for the outgoing spokeswoman is that she and I would go on a Club Med vacation to Sri Lanka. Everyone seemed to get a kick out of that. But
Okay. So I don't know if I'm sensing from you that you weren't t entirely flattered by the attention, but I would only suggest that I know you've had your differences with the 38th floor. And it sometimes is stressful, but I do think that there is among many people there a real appreciation for the role that you play in, maybe not always highlighting the issues they want you to highlight, but being kind of a dogged questioner. I mean, because as you say, the mainstream media is slowly but surely pulling out
That was
of
Richard Roth's
its
other joke. He was like, soon there'll be only a bearded blogger at the UN. All the, because I mean, I just went and visited the new space. No, it's not so much, I'm not trying to play sort of like uncomfortable. It was kind of it was an honor. I think it was just sort of a fluke. Like, I don't think the various speakers like, you know, kind of coordinated. So they each wanted to make a joke, but
but that's amazing that if they didn't coordinate it and you turned
up. That's
why.
But that's why, and I think it really is a kind of it's more a product of just a different approach. No. The only thing we're gonna, you know, in a moment we're gonna talk about Darfur, the Congo, a hunger striker. So I'm very clear that the UN press corps is not the center of the universe. But it was just sort of it's strange over here these days. I mean, the Washington Post, I'll give you this as an example. I was just exploring the new, they call it a temporary swing space, small offices with no, it's the whistleblower free zone, I've called it. But literally, I don't think that there are some major publications that have not, and it's free space, but they're not booking it over there. So it's kind of brutal.
It is. All right. Well, okay. Now,
but speaking of brutal, why don't we talk about Darfur?
Okay. You know? All right. Go ahead. We've got sort of a list of basket case situations in Africa to talk about.
I know, it's
I
a
also
shame.
Want to talk
I've
about.
To, we'll try to. We can so, talk about the World Cup, you know, but we'll talk. I mean, on Darfur, and I think it's actually there's been, you know, in the last few days, there's been various attacks on peacekeepers. 5 peacekeepers were killed. 2 have been taken hostage. Ban Ki-moon, after the Secretary General, after not speaking with the President of Sudan since he was indicted by the International Criminal Court, very much having been advised to, you know, keep his distance from an indicted war criminal.
Mm-hmm, yep.
On Sunday, he called him. And it was sort of, this was this news spokesman's first day, and his first announcement that he had to give was that on purely humanitarian grounds, that was his first phrase, on purely humanitarian grounds, the Secretary General called President al-Bashir of Sudan over the weekend and you know, was very strong about these 2 UN staff members taken hostage. You know, the Sudanese media, on the other hand, their headline for the call was Ban Ki-moon expresses unwavering and unrelenting support to President al-Bashir. So I asked him, you know, do you deny that that's what he did? And I think actually it may bode well. He said, you should believe me and not the Sudanese media.
Absolutely.
So that was pretty good. I thought in the past, actually, you know, I think the prior, at least spokesperson administration here would have said, you know, why are you asking? And, I mean, you have to rebut that. The thing about it is that, you know, the question becomes, I think the real reason for the call, to be honest, was they slipped it in their own announcement. And this is sort of the either news or analysis piece of this, is that the UN has appointed a new, along with the African Union, a special envoy, special representative to Darfur. And it's a guy, it's a well, you know, at least in UN circles.
It's Gambari, isn't it?
Yeah, well-known former foreign minister of Nigeria under the Sani Abacha military government, former ambassador to the UN, and most recently, he was the UN sort of special envoy to Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma. And what I thought was interesting about it is that most of the sort of human rights NGOs or Burma-focused NGOs have been critical of Gambari's performance there. They found him, you know, too close to the military government, you know, too slow to speak out against, you know, the beating of monks, various things. So it's interesting that a person that's sort of, at least, and I know him, he's a perfectly nice guy, but a person that's thought of as sort of weak on human rights would get this pretty, in the UN system, a pretty high-profile human rights-related post, which is, you know, special representative to Darfur, which many people say is in genocide, whose the president of the country has been indicted. So this sort of like, I don't know what you think it means. I have a couple of stabs at it, but.
The one thing that always bothers me a little bit about these high-profile appointments, especially a former senior UN ambassadors, I understand why the Secretary General reaches into the pool of experienced, seasoned ambassadors to send them as his special representative for these problem spots. But at the same time, I sometimes wish the UN would, you know, break that mold, reach beyond that narrow field, and get some fresh blood. I understand Gambari is seen as a pro, and he's probably seen in this case as knowing where all the equities are, and he knows how to show up and he knows exactly what the Security Council is expecting of him and what the Secretary General, and he's sort of a known entity, and I think that there's safety in that. But I do sometimes wish the UN would step away from that, especially with these high profile appointees, especially in a situation like Darfur where there is genocide occurring.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the way it's been explained to me, is that, and the first one who explained it to me was actually an ambassador of an African country that will remain unnamed, who was an applicant for the post. I mean, it was pretty clear that it would go to an African, because Sudan has rebelled. You may remember that a former representative to the North-South conflict of Sudan was Jan Pronk, this Dutch politician, and they threw him out of the country. So the idea is sort of like, okay, it was going to be an African, but as it turned out, as it got closer to this election, Nigeria, which is the largest peacekeeping contributor to the Darfur mission, UNAMID, threatened to pull its troops if it didn't get the post. This is according to an ambassador who withdrew his name out of, he said, respect for Nigeria. But the point was, and a lot of people wonder whether, you know, it's one thing to say, and I think later I may say, I don't necessarily think it's wrong to sort of have continental and say, like, you know, at least some development post in the UN should go to an African. But this was a straight up, like we'll pull our troops if we don't get the post.
But Matthew, this happens all the time in the UN system, right? I mean, people have to understand that in these regional groupings, when you pick your nominee for president of the General Assembly or chairman of this or that committee, you know, the region gets together, decides who the nominees are going to be, and there's all kinds of ugly horse trading that goes, you owe me, anyway, I mean,
it was interesting because actually, if for people that think that that's sort of like the regional group doing it and then just presenting one person and there being no opposition, this was kind of an open fight. Like the Tanzanians had two candidates. There were various candidates around. But ultimately, when Nigeria, that has all these troops there, said, we'll pull out if we don't get the post, that was it. So the way the secretariat explains this by saying, like, look, we could have done worse. You know, Gambari is sort of either the best Nigerian they could have selected. They needed the consent of Sudan, right? They can't send, Mia Farrow as the special representative. Or actually, maybe Sudan would take her to ridicule it. But they need someone and that's, I think, here's what I find surprising is I've kind of, you know, to toot my horn, I learned that he'd been given the job several days before it was announced, mostly from that ambassador. So, you know, I got it confirmed by people that Gambari was already trying to hire to work for him in Darfur. So, you know, I bounced around. I asked at the noon briefing, and they refused to confirm it. But I basically tried to get comment from the big, well, I consider them, you know, big Darfur-focused NGOs, the Enough Project, Save Darfur Coalition, stuff like that. Because it actually struck me like, okay, he'd been offered the job, but it hadn't been confirmed yet. The letter hadn't been
sent. Oh, so you thought you could, like, foment some dissent behind the scenes
let me put it this way. More journalistically, it seemed like, you know, the time for an advocacy group that says there's genocide in Darfur and the UN should be stronger, the time that it would seem to me that they would want to speak is before the thing is set in stone, right? Once the guy has the job, they're going to try to get along with it. But the irony to me is that they resisted. I don't know if it was fomenting or not. I just think, like, you know, journalistically, there's a time that you try to – a quote is more newsworthy, let's put it that way, on a moving target than one that's already set in stone.
Right.
But they didn't. And this is why I find it very strange, is that the moment that it was confirmed, the NGOs that work on Burma all said, you know, goodbye and good riddance to Gambari. We want a much stronger special envoy in the future. So they kind of unloaded on him. I guess, you know, and what some people are saying is maybe these groups are smart enough to know they can't stop it, so go with the program. Maybe, and this is the sort of missing piece, and I think the reason that I wanted to discuss this. A country highly involved in all this said this to me, and this could just be mischief, but that one of the explanations for the switch of Gambari from Burma to Darfur was that the UK, which is highly concerned, you know, they've long been, it's a former colony, right, Burma. So they're constantly critical of the military government and saying Aung San Suu Kyi should be freed. But they were so frustrated with Gambari's performance in Myanmar that they're like, get him out. And in fact, less than giving the Darfur post, it was sort of like, get him out of something. But then this obviously implies that Burma is more important to the UK than Darfur, which is not.
So you think it's big power politics?
I spent 2 days trying to get Susan Rice to comment on this before it was confirmed, the U.S. ambassador here. And the reason is this is really her area of expertise, and much more so than others in the Obama administration, she's on the record saying it's a genocide, it's an outrage, it must stop. So I'll go out on a limb here and say, in my heart of hearts, I believe I don't think this is the choice that she would have made for this program.
Maybe not, but here's one thing. I bet you Susan remembers Gambari from her time as Assistant Secretary of Africa, and probably remembers him being a helpful member of the Security Council to the United States at that time. And so she probably, I'm just guessing here, she probably sees him as maybe the least bad of many other options.
Again, that's I think there's there was something. Maybe it's just that none of this has become public, or it was impossible to get down to. But I would have thought, as an observer of the process, that the Enough Project, the Save Darfur Coalition, that these groups have enough input and leverage in the Obama administration that they should have at least said
something. They could have made some noise.
To get that explanation made public, that this was the least of all, because this is what I'll say, is being a reporter here, we go to all these kind of background, off-the-record briefings of particular Security Council members. Everyone wants to pitch their position. And I'll say pretty uniformly, the Western powers, let's put it that way, they trash Gambari in secret. I mean, in briefings. This is why it's widely known that they were unhappy with his performance. They somehow contrast Ban Ki-moon going to Myanmar and not accomplishing much with Gambari. And they say, well, Ban at least tried, and he was critical. But they really, there are many, and these are major, countries, seem to, and the U.S., I guess with the change of administration, maybe it's true. Maybe it's the two sides of Susan Rice. On the one hand, play well and get not, play well at the U.N., and if this is the choice. I mean, the first time I asked her, she just said, we support the Secretary General. And then once it was confirmed, she said, we look forward to working with Mr. Gambari, but he should be vigilant and all the things that he should do. My prediction is that in some months, you're going to have not just the NGOs, but even the U.S., being critical of Gambari.
Well, you heard it here first.
And I think then, that's why I don't see this as fomenting trouble, but the point will be to go back and say, all of this was totally predictable. You know what I mean? You do know what you're getting with Gambari. And I think there are a lot of people in the UN system that like his style, which is it's a very government-centric, or some people say he made a pitch to Myanmar. He said, look, he used to be the foreign minister of Nigeria. It was thought of as a corrupt military dictatorship, and he managed, he would claim to help them turn that around and be perceived differently. Now it's just thought of as corrupt, right? Just joking. But and that this is sort of a pitch, he has it's a different approach, let's say, than a sort of a more, some kind of EU parliamentarian. Maybe it's more effective. His thing would say, the proof is in the pudding. But, the question is, what pudding are you trying to cook? If you're trying to cook a pudding that reestablishes the control of Khartoum over all aspects of its country, that's one pudding. And I kind of think that that's what military governments like to do.
Yeah, look, I don't want to come out as the defender of Gambari in this instance, but I'm just pragmatic about it. I don't know how much we can expect any UN mm-hmm. special representative really to accomplish in this case. So, we'll see. We'll watch the space and check back in a few months,
We can turn to another. I'll go.
Are we going to Congo?
We are. We're going to trash another SRSG, but we'll set up the facts. And actually, we can go mainstream. There was a. Last Sunday,
there was a 60 Minutes piece.
It's more than, this is being done Tuesday, so about 9 days ago, there was a 60 Minutes piece, pretty much longer than I thought it was going to be, on conflict, resources in the Congo. And 60 Minutes went with the camera, and they showed, mining under both rebel-controlled areas and the thing right now about the Congo is that when you say it's the government against the rebels, a large part of the government soldiers are, until quite recently, rebels of the CNDP, which were the sort of Rwandan-backed...
Right, so maybe we need even a little, just a tiny bit more context for people who don't follow Africa. So everyone will remember, of course, that this is the country that used to be known as Zaire, that was ruled for many years by...
Mobutu
Sese Seko, right?
You got it.
Was he famous for coming to Washington, D.C. and renting a train and going from New
York? He appeared in leopard skin with Ronald Reagan.
Leopard. That's right.
And he ended up with $2 billion parked in Europe.
The emperor, right. Yeah. Okay, so then he was overthrown by Kabila, mm-hmm. and now Kabila's son is president.
Kabila is very much backed by Rwanda, which is kind of, the irony of the Congo is that it's an enormous country with incredible resources that has until recently been, its politics have been dominated and actually its capital captured by tiny Rwanda next door for good reason in many people's view. In some people's view, I'm not trying to say it's not true by saying it's some people's view, but in 1994 in the genocide in Rwanda, the Hutu majority of Rwanda that committed largely the genocide fled into the Congo. And so ever since, Rwanda has felt, the Rwandan government, now run by the minority Tutsis, have felt that they have a right to and should cross the border in order to root out these former genocide there. And so basically,
right.
Congo
so
now...
this is a continuation in many respects.
Although
of
it's generational. I mean, the thing that's strange about it is that people always call the two, until recently, the two rebel groups in eastern Congo, the FDLR, thought largely of being, you know, Hutu and even ex-genocidaire, versus the CNDP, thought of as being Rwandan Tutsis that are trying to, like, you know, make sure these genocidaires don't come back. There's only one problem, is that life expectancy and age being what it is, the current FDLR, you know, were literally like 5-year-old children during the genocide. So certainly, I guess if you're the child of a genocidaire, you're a genocidaire. But these are not largely the same people, you know?
So into this mess, and it's really horrible. And by the way, the images, I watched the 60 Minutes piece of children mining
by hand.
By hand. Yep. It's heartbreaking, especially, you know, in light of my Year Without a Santa Claus.
Sure, I see what you're saying. No, no, it really was. I agree. That was
horrifying. But into this, the UN has waited, and with very imperfect results, with a peacekeeping force with the French acronym of MONUC, right?
That's right, MONUC, and they've been. It's now they're almost tied, but until quite recently, it's been the largest UN peacekeeping force. And they've kind of run the Congo. I mean, they ran the elections. Now you can say that Kabila is a you know, officially elected president. But I went on the Security Council trip there in 2008. And when you go out to eastern Congo, like Goma, basically the whole airport is run by the UN. All the planes are UN.
I mean, Goma was the staging point for all the big relief operations that the U.S. managed in 94.
Yeah, it's just across the border from Rwanda, actually.
Right.
It ended up that the Security Council's plane got shot from inside by a UN guard. We had to take a bus from Goma across the border to Rwanda, which is literally, it's like right on the border. It's a beautiful place. I mean, the other thing you have to, and I'm sure you saw it on the 60 Minutes thing. I mean, it's like, it has volcanoes. It's lush. It's not at all, desert. It's like, that's what's so weird. I mean, not weird. It's literally, it's both physically beautiful and incredibly rich in minerals. And for that reason, I mean, I think, and this is maybe we'll this fight between the FDLR and the CNDP, which has been recently converted into a fight between the Congolese government, with now CNDP ex-rebels brought into the army, versus the FDLR, both sides are largely funded by illegal mining of gold and tantalum and cassiterite and coltan. This is sort of when you hear the thing of, like, you know, your cell phone comes from slave labor in the Congo. This is what they're talking about. And so recently the UN, you know, people have known about this problem for some time, and the UN Security Council has armed, you know, armed sanctions on the rebel groups in the Congo, and produces these unbelievable, in fact, I'll whip it out and put it on camera, 200 page reports, on armed sanctions. And this year they focused a lot, and I think in a way the 60 Minutes piece is related and sort of they feed back onto each other. They focused a lot on this illegal exploitation of natural resources and who's doing it. And what was interesting about the report, and it's very long, and I would encourage it, it's online, I linked to it in an article, but, okay, there's no question that this report says that the ex-CNDP, government units, that the UN is assisting with logistical support like helicopter flights and gasoline and food, these units are also forcing children to do mining and are taking the gold, you know, in this case, they don't really, you know, to fund their operations or just to take it. So, what leapt out at me, not just me, but The Economist ended up writing about this report when it came out in leaked fashion, is, you know, that this is an indictment of the UN for essentially having sided with not only, you know, killers and murderers, but illegal mining as well.
Right.
There's no question that that's in the report. Now, it's true, there's more pages of the report devoted to how bad the FDLR is. And everyone knows this is probably, along with the Lord's Resistance Army, one of the worst groups on earth, and it has, you know, funding from a diaspora in Europe and Canada and elsewhere. And so, but I think as media people, not just people, you know, sort of watchdogging the UN, but I mean, I take the economy, you know, they're a pretty objective publication. It's always bigger news if the cops are, you know, the fact that there's drugs being sold, in a ghetto is one thing. I'm not saying it's not news, but when you discover the cops assisting the drug dealers, this is a bigger story, right? Because
no,
that's why it doesn't get
cleaned
up.
There's no question about that.
Say again?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I'm just not sure. I mean, I think I see where you're
where I'm going
with this,
is that ironically, and then we can go back to the 60 Minutes thing, but only yesterday, this is why it's fresh in my mind, the the chairman or coordinator of this group of experts that did this 298-page
right.
report.
By the way, this was a funny thing. This wasn't like a UN, this was an independent group of experts.
That's right? The question, and you'll see it is described as an independent group of experts. They are appointed by the Secretary General and approved by the Security Council, and they're flown around and driven around by Minook.
But who pays them? The UN pays them.
Yes.
So then why aren't they, why is there this funny distinction without a difference then?
Because I think the idea is that they don't want, I mean, that's what's so strange. They want these guys, unlike what you were saying, like choosing the insider in Gambari, these guys, like the current guy, used to be a journalist. He was a Reuters, Dinesh Mattani.
Is the UN trying to do the same thing that they did with Sierra Leone and Conflict Diamonds?
That's definitely on the table, and that was discussed in 60 Minutes, and it's discussed, the idea is that it's gonna be, you know, diamonds is sort of a smaller trade and it's more regulated. This is, with gold and this stuff, a lot of it gets shipped out to like smelters in Malaysia.
Right.
There's
in
a lot
Dubai
of talk of China. It's much less regulated. But here's what was strange. The report came out. I mean, to me, it was like, it's sort of a piece with Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and Oxfam. All of them have been saying to the UN for months now, you've made a mistake by siding with this operation by the government using former rebels to fight other rebels, in which both sides are torching villages, raping women, like, it's horrendous. And the UN, rather than sort of like being somehow either in the middle or at least like stepping back and saying, you know, we can't take part in this, is actively assisting one side, which honestly is behaving no better than the other side. So you have this irony of sort of like under the color of the blue flag, you know, villages being burned. So the UN has responded by no longer assisting a single unit, one unit of the Congolese army has been disqualified. But the other ones keep doing it. So what was strange is that when the expert finally came to brief us on his report, after it had been leaked, but then it came out officially,
right,
he suddenly was very defensive and said, you know, it's been misreported that this report's against the UN. That's just a small part of it. You need to focus on the FDLR. And it was, many people here were sort of struck by, like, you know, how independent it was. And sitting next to him as he did this was a UN Secretariat employee. It pretty much seemed clear that they'd written this report. I guess what I'm saying is maybe they need to take the fig leaf off. Maybe it's if you're appointed by the Secretary General and if you're paid by the UN and if you're flown around by the UN peacekeeping mission, maybe you can't call yourself independent. You just have to acknowledge
that
you're studying the country, but your study has an enormous blind spot.
I'm just not sure I understand what objective their so-called independence was achieving with respect to the United Nations. Was it so that the Secretary General could distance himself from the findings?
In part, maybe that's so. It's sort of like, it's along the lines of like the special rapporteurs, where the Human Rights Council will appoint people to look into extrajudicial justice.
Right.
You know, but it always allows them to say, like, these guys are independent. That's not our
view. Right.
So maybe that was the, but it was never,
important.
I don't think initially when they got into it, because I will say this, here's the problem in the Congo. Now, many people always say to me, well, you know, it's bad now, but it's not as bad as it was because the fighting is confined to the East and finally there was an election. That may all be true. But I think that the morality and ethics of the UN's involvement in the Congo has become much more questionable since I've been looking closely at the issue for like the last 2 or 3 years. And you can blame the Security Council as well. By them, because not that they made a bad decision in the abstract of saying, we are now going to, you know, support militarily the government. Usually the UN doesn't do that, right? You always hear this phrase, the UN doesn't go in when there's not a peace to keep, and, you know, it's sort of highly objective. This is one where they're literally providing military support to a government to fight rebels. The problem is that the government's not acting right, and the UN is too far down the road in the strategy to say, we've screwed up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with Mr. Gambari's equivalent in the Congo is this guy called Alan Doss.
Right.
And he came to the stakeout, and you say to him, well, what about evidence that the units you're working with, you know, committed these massacres? And he's like, well, there's not enough evidence. And the question is, it's almost like he was being kind of like, well, until it's proved to a certainty what the UN's own special rapporteur is saying, which is that a unit, you know, commanded by a guy called Innocent Zemulinda, you know, torched a village, killed 80 people, and mass raped 50 women. This is all based on like multiple witnesses. The UN's response was, well, until that's better proved, we're going to keep working with that unit. Ironically, the same unit with a slightly different spelling, Zemulinda, shows up in the resource exploitation with the guy enslaving children to take out gold. So now what some people would say is, why focus on the UN? You should focus on this terrible innocent Zemulinda. And I agree, this guy's, he probably is, you know, merits you know, indictment by the ICC, et cetera. But the question is, why is the UN giving this unit food and giving it gas and saying when you fight, if, you know, if you get injured while burning the village, we'll take you out with a helicopter
for
medical treatment. And that's currently what's happening.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think that no person could dispute the horrific nature of the facts outlined in this report. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing to argue with here. But I mean, but I think a bigger question is, what is it the UN can do in a macro sense to make its peacekeeping more effective? Train people better, equip them better, ensure that local politics don't enter into, which is the case here, right? The peacekeepers haven't been able to divorce themselves from their from what the baggage that they bring from home to their job, right?
Is the solution
to send the Fijians to Africa and the, I mean, like, what's the solution?
Well,
right?
I mean, I wouldn't actually, I mean, I think a lot of the things, there are other overarching problems with peacekeeping, which is like, you know, impunity. For example, if and when peacekeepers commit, you know, rape or sexual abuse, nothing happens to them except being sent back home, and then there's no report of whatever happens to them. So these are systemic problems. I think the Congo one is really, it's two different things. The Security Council may, on balance, have made a mistake by saying, let's, for the, one of the first times in UN history, like, take active part in a military assault against rebels. And the problem is, and I'll say this, I think that on the ground, at the level of the leadership of MONUC, there was a kind of, they lost their way. Like, no matter what the Security Council says, look at Romeo Dallaire in Rwanda, right? The guy who said,
yep,
I'm not going
to
leave, this is genocide. You have to count on somebody working for the UN to have some kind of a moral compass to say, although I could certainly say the Security Council in a resolution 6 months ago authorized this, when I find myself ferrying food and supplies to a unit that just burned a village down,
yep,
I've got to stop. Even absent the Security Council passing a new resolution,
I'm sure that there are procedures in place to deal with rogue units, right?
They've announced a policy that they won't support. When I say the rogue units, these are units of the Congolese army that the UN is supporting. I mean, thank God we haven't reached the point. There have been some bad behavior by UN peacekeepers, but it's not. What we're talking about here is really like people that are just like 2 months ago were a rebel group that would rampage through and like torch villages and steal everything are now with the government. But since the UN has said we're going to work with the government, they're assisting those units. So it's, I want to be clear. It's not like this is the Pakistani unit. There were some allegations of both the Pakistani and Indians sort of like, you know, trading weapons and, you know, buying prostitutes. That was about the assault, the extent of it. The problem is this providing of essentially military logistical assistance to units that are out of control, and it shouldn't you don't have time to hold a whole trial about the unit before the UN should pull the plug. That was my thing. It's like, and it just seems like there, and the problem you also have is that the UN has allowed the head of the MONUC unit, he's caught in, you know, maybe I make too much of it, but sort of a nepotism and corruption scandal in which he rode in and got his daughter a job in UNDP. I mean, it's a big enough thing that even Ban Ki-moon had to say, I take this seriously and I'm investigating it. Given that, I'm not saying they should have replaced him then, or that he's so distracted that he has an excuse to not have focused on these issues. But you can't have, you know, a fish rots from the head. It's like, you can't.
That's fair enough.
You don't want to be a unit in a country that's in which corruption is endemic. The head of the UN mission shouldn't himself be accused of corruption. I mean, you know, you should. They could have found a classy way. They could have pulled a Gombari with him. Let's send him somewhere else. You know, but there's something has gone wrong, and I think that the problem is that obviously it's a really tragic country because it's beautiful. The people, I have to say, I mean, all people are wonderful, but just in the time that I was there on the Security Council trip, it's just very vibrant. You know, like, people are really trying hard. You know, it's like in Eastern Congo, they build bicycles out of wood. Like big wooden tires and like a joist, a big beam, and these guys are carrying like 200 pounds of bags on like a wooden bicycle up a steep lush hill and just busting it out. And in the capital Kinshasa, these guys have like literally like 20 year old photocopy machines running on a generator, and are like, do you need any copies?
Wow.
I mean, I'm not saying that this is a great business strategy, but I am saying it sort of, it kills you then to see, especially like, again, it's not the UN's fault that there are these vicious rebels. But, you know, it's always, I believe in this, like first.
No, Zaire, I mean, the Democratic Republic of Congo should not be a basket case country by any measure. It shouldn't be. So,
the new group is China, as you may know. China signed a $9 billion, since diminished at the request of the International Monetary Fund, but $9 billion mineral and resources deal in which Congo, the president of the Congo, with virtually no legislative or other, you know, knowledge or support, signed a deal with China in which he ceded large mining concessions to China in exchange for roads and stuff. And, you know, as is often the case, zero.
I'm sure it was completely transparent and corruption free.
Exactly.
I'm sure.
And that's the kind of, and then you'll ask the UN, they're like, well, we can't, it's a sovereign country. It's kind of like, the reality is, there's, and this is, I guess, the last, you know, I end up looking a lot at, like, you know, the UN in the Congo or the UN in Haiti. You know, it's not to say, there are places where the UN is actually, I hate to say it, not that big a deal. I mean, I would even say Iraq is one of them, to some degree, Afghanistan, where it's like,
true,
you know, the
right?
big player is the U.S., obviously, in
right.
both those cases.
Mm-hmm.
But even in some, there are other places where they're at, but there are some places where they should just be honest. They're basically running the country. It's not, I mean, in Timor-Leste, they did it openly. And they said, we're going to take you from a former colony to being a state. But for the longest time now, in both Haiti and the Congo, Haiti, you could say they're doing it on behalf of the U.S. Of the U.S. But in the Congo, really, they are the, you know, you go to Eastern Congo and everything is U.N. In fact, the independent expert said how they couldn't have written their report without Mani's support. Because there's no other planes, there's no other cars, nothing. So, in a way, there, I think they have a particular responsibility. I don't think they can make it paradise on Earth. You know what I mean?
No.
But, like, the fact that after all this time and all this money, they're assisting government units who have kids digging gold with their hands is a problem.
It's a problem.
You know?
Yep.
I don't know.
I don't know what else to say. It's a huge problem. And no one can watch those images, hear this story, and not want to, I think that the one tangible initiative that came from the 60 Minutes expose is clearly to require accountability on sourcing.
Sure.
And Walmart seems really favorable. This is the PR nightmare. The optics of this are completely bad from every angle.
Sure.
So I think Walmart wants to get on the right side of this, understandably. Okay. Well, maybe we can transition to
Let's talk nukes. I want to sit back and pour a little Mountain Dew.
I always like to try to find the positive in the United Nations.
Yep.
And because I really do think there's an enormous amount of good, even in these horrifying peacekeeping operations that go awry that we've been talking about. I still think that in the aggregate, there's more good that's done than bad. Anyway,
sure.
But what I wanted to highlight actually isn't a UN Secretariat issue. It's about the changing role of the United States at the United Nations. And my cell phone's going off in the background. It's really distracting. I think it's a child at school who left.
Check it out.
Home. That's okay. I'm confident that this particular child will survive.
Okay.
do you have time? Do you ever go to the UN First Committee meetings? Do you ever?
I do. I do.
I
usually get wait because all the committees kind of meet at one time, and I'm usually I'm most attracted to the Budget Committee and the Human Rights, which is the third committee. But I do go to the first.
Okay, so the first committee is the committee that deals with peace and disarmament issues, and you know the General Assembly is broken up into various committees that go away and do their work, and the committees develop resolutions and vote on them in committee, and then they're transferred to the huge General Assembly body, and then they're all voted on at the end of December, like in a couple weeks, right?
Yep.
There's going to be the big.
Yep. There's a big December is vote. Yeah. All the committees
conclude
their work and everybody votes. And
So in committee now, the first committee has been taking up these resolutions, and what's fascinating to me is the difference between this year and last year with respect to the Obama administration and the Bush administration. So there are, the U.S. historically never fears, and never should fear if it has valid reasons, voting against, even if it stands very alone in a very small minority against resolutions that it doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of resolutions that come up that, for example, the U.S. will be a strong supporter of Israel. If there is a General Assembly resolution that singles out Israel, beats it over the head for having nuclear weapons, the U.S. is going to vote no on that resolution. Or
defamation of religion, that's another
one. So there are lots of loaded things that come up in these resolutions. Anyway, what's interesting about this year is that and I haven't been able to do, obviously, an analysis of every single resolution, but there were 58 resolutions tabled in the first committee as opposed to 55 last year. Mm-hmm. And last year, the U.S. abstained or voted no 23 times. It's like, not quite half, but sure, a significant minority. And this year, that number's decreased to 16. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is joining consensus or joining with the majority, I think much more often now. And one resolution that stood out to me is one having to do with general and complete disarmament. And this is really important as we move into the run-up to the all-important May 2010 mm-hmm. NPT Review Conference, which is just going to be huge.
Mm-hmm.
I think it runs from May 3rd, pretty much the whole month of May. And this is a resolution that I believe was sponsored by Japan. I believe was drafted by Japan.
This is their issue. That's all I can say.
Yeah, this is their issue. But there are lots of resolutions in the first committee that say they're about to. There are like so many different variants on disarmament. And
Central Asia is a nuclear-free zone.
Yeah, but anyway, so this one, for the first time, the U.S. joined consensus, mm-hmm. and not only consensus, but was a co-sponsor of this resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a big shift for the United States, and I think it's an important one.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that behind it reflects a really important shift toward support generally for disarmament,
mm-hmm.
which the United States is always a little bit sat on its hands about, especially during the Bush years. And, the big battle looming, battle is not quite the right word, with the NPT Review Conference is to both strengthen the treaty with respect to nonproliferation and advance disarmament. And I think, and you may disagree with this, but I think the United States is now moving closer to, being a very, very strong advocate of disarmament, perhaps more quickly than some of our allies in the P5. And I think that France, for example, which I noticed was not a co-sponsor mm-hmm. of the resolution, I'd have to look up how they voted on it. But anyway, this is a really interesting trend where the United States is sort of in the lead now with respect to disarmament and maybe trying to bring along behind it countries mm-hmm. like France, Russia, China, and the UK. Well, not so much the UK, but anyway,
I agree. I've seen this process of the UN. Of the US. Obviously changing its position and trying to. I mean, it's the same thing on the International Criminal Court. They're obviously not a member, but they went to this conference of state parties and participated in it. They brought their. I know it's just. So the trend is very much the Obama administration sort of playing nicer at the UN. I think even as you were saying that, I could picture some conservatives saying like that's not necessarily the test of anything, like abstaining and objecting less. If anything, they should be doing it more. I think the way I would say it is, and this is one I don't think it's a conservative or a liberal position. There are a few issues such as like UN reform or like anti-corruption on which the U.S. has, at least since I was looking at it, was kind of the leader, And not necessarily only because of kind of John Bolton and the Republicans, but even under the Clinton administration, I think they were beating the drum in terms of, sometimes it was just them being cheap and not wanting, we don't want to spend money. But I think where you see, this is not necessarily an issue where I don't even think the UN system or secretariat is well served by the U.S. saying, well, we'll just kind of go along to get along, I think that there's much less, maybe, they did it too aggressively under the Bush administration and they had this guy Mark Wallace, and you would say, this is an outrage. We need, we need an audit. We need an investigation. But now, things happen. I recently worked on the case.
Oh, so you're worried? Are you worried that the U.S. isn't being aggressive enough in rooting out corruption?
I am. I think that their main focus here now is being seen as sort of playing well with others. And although they may criticize things that go wrong, they'll definitely do it behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And I think that you have a lot less leverage doing that. That's my sense. The way it comes up is, for example, whistleblowers. Okay? Under the previous, and this is not with, you know, recently, under the current one, a guy approached me that worked for the UN. I'm sorry to go back to this. In the Congo, he was a national staff member, and he was sent out to help with disarmament work of militias. He did it sort of with this like old, like really like 1980s style, like big video camera on his shoulder, and he talked to them and he filmed them. And then one of the groups that he was helping disarm, the guy got indicted by the ICC. He claims that he fell under sort of physical threat because he'd been filming this guy. He wasn't filming war crimes per se, but he filmed meetings at which these people participated. So he fled the country and got asylum in the U.S. Then he approached the UN and tried to say, you know, I was put at risk and can, you know, I saw some bad things in the Congo. I want to bring my family over. Can you assist? And they've entirely rebuffed him. The bad things that he saw involved, like, the theft of jet fuel from the Bunia airport.
Oh, right,
airport.
I read about this.
Yeah,
yes,
and so...
You wrote about
I
this.
I think... I will say this. I would be willing to bet money that under... Certainly under Bolton, but even under Khalilzad, that if an individual, you know, was in New York and being sort of, rebuffed... I mean, he ended up having to, like, email Ban Ki-moon and say, I'm going to step in front of your car to deliver my letter. And then he was then met by the NYC Police Department Threat Assessment Unit as if he was, like, a terrorist.
Yeah.
But this guy, had he in the past, had, especially not because of the warlord angle, but because of the whistleblowing witness to...
But the Bolton-era, you know, protection of UN whistleblowers, that was politically motivated.
I guess I'm saying, my point is that if you're a whistleblower, maybe the U.S.'s motive for saying, yes, we're going to champion your cause... is tainted in some way.
Yeah, and
but
by
it's
the
no
way,
better
Bolton
to have
was not
I think it looks worse for the UN system to have a UN employee who's literally trying, number one, trying to save his family, but number two, has evidence, has photographs of UN vehicles filled with jerry cans filled with gas. Somebody's supposed to listen. And it's nice to be concerned about all these big issues and to want to be a friend of all the world, but if the result is that when the UN blows you off, there's no watchdog, the mission of no country is willing to say, let me hear you out.
Okay, look, I don't want to debate the merits of this particular guy's argument. I'm sure that he had absolutely a strong case, and he should have been listened to and had his case taken seriously in the UN. But I do want to take issue with your larger point, which is that the U.S. is, by not being confrontational in John Bolton style in its approach at the UN, is losing its leverage. I think just the opposite. I think when you're quiet and you do sometimes publicly go along to get along, and then privately behind the scenes make your point heard, I think that makes you sometimes much more effective.
I think in the abstract I don't disagree with you at all. I'm saying on this specific issue, UN waste, fraud, and abuse, I'm not at all sure what is being done behind the scenes. It took them many months to even fill the position of the expert at the mission for management and UN reform. And the guy they selected, as reported in the Washington Post, has his own ethical issues. So I have
By
to
the
say,
way, do you know the name off the top of your head of the guy they selected?
I don't, actually.
I'm
sorry.
Just curious, because I remember
We'll link to that piece. I sort of didn't do it, because to be honest, like once Colin wrote the piece, I was like, all right, I had this. I actually had a lot of that stuff. But it's more, and I haven't, you know what it is, maybe I should have held my tongue, because I'm waiting to do a piece on this when enough things accumulate.
Okay,
because you kind of can't by negative inference. I guess, here's what I'm saying, and again, maybe it's also, maybe this is just as petty as a journalistical thing, but in the past, there have been, even in the last few months, there have been various sort of, UN program overspending, and sort of like, and maybe that was just Bolton trying to beat up the UN, but when something bad would happen, this guy would come to the stakeout and say, this is serious, somebody has to be held accountable.
You know,
and
Bolton would come to the stakeout and say that when it met his political objectives to do that.
But let's see. I haven't seen the U.S. throw its muscle behind. It's kind of like, I mean, there's different kinds of politics, Jackie. That's all I would say is that there may be a politics of sort of destruction and trashing the U.N., but then there's something where not just this, let's say, the one whistleblower from the Congo, but where if the politics are to be seen as playing better at the U.N., then things that come along that probably objectively should have been worked on weren't, because they're not consistent with the sort of the overall political message.
Okay, well, here's what
I
just
believe most
suggest.
Americans, they might like the UN, but they have a sense that there are things that should be cleaned up.
Okay, what I want to suggest
Go
is
ahead.
That this isn't a case of the U.S. just playing nicer at the UN, like in the sandbox.
Okay.
I think that this is a case of the U.S. and in the disarmament area in particular, reassessing its national security objectives, its strategic priorities, and saying, you know what? nuclear weapons aren't advancing our national security. We've got to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And we're going to cooperate with people in multiple venues to do this. We're going to do this at the NPT Review Conference. We're going to do it at the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva. We're going to work towards CTBT ratification. We're going to do a whole bunch of things. We're going to renew START with Russia. We're going to do a whole bunch of things that advance this agenda. Part of that is going to be maybe playing nicer at the UN, but it's not playing nicer for the sake of being nicer. And I just think that that's
yeah, no, I didn't mean to be particularly on this issue. That, I mean, I didn't mean to be over. I think that there are some where it really is like they're sort of so proud that, like, you know, that Susan Rice goes to the Committee on Peacekeeping, you know, rather, you know, like,
well, okay, but I just want to say one more thing.
Have the U.S. given
this.
A single peacekeeper since they've come in?
Okay,
no.
that's, you know, that's probably a
that's
valid
just
criticism.
Attending meetings,
but here's
to
the
say,
thing, there's
I was
there's
there
a
and
trauma.
I, you know, I gave the, let's talk about, you know, mine ban. Is the U.S. ban, you know, anyway.
The landmine. We can't get rid of the mines, I think, on the along the DMZ in Korea, and we want to keep our mines by silo-based warheads. So when we get rid of the nuclear weapons, we can get rid of the landmines around them. And then when we denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, we'll get rid of those landmines.
This could well be an issue in which it really there's actually some substance to playing better.
Yes.
Correct. I'm just saying maybe we'll do it in another episode of this. We can identify that's not true of all issues. And I always hate kind of generalities. Like, I don't disagree that, like, playing behind the scenes could do better. It's not like I'm, like, in favor of confrontation. But I'm just saying that there are specifics,
you know,
on the, like, UN reform issue here. There's not a lot of traction.
I just don't think we know. As you pointed out yourself, the guy's just come into the job. So maybe it's too soon to say yet. I'll enthusiastically await your assessment.
But speaking of not so much, I mean, not like outright corruption, but sort of like UN sloppiness on what would be considered ethics, I think, in almost any other governmental or intergovernmental situation. There is, and I guess it sort of amazed me, and since it's a big name, we'll go for the gusto. Tony Blair, right?
Wait, are we transitioning? Okay, wait.
I'm feeling the transition. I don't want to transition too much.
Never mind. I was going to... never mind.
Never mind. Go ahead.
No, okay, the only other small point I wanted to make on this issue about... Because I really want to defend this
small.
Notion about... I want to just defend the notion of the U.S. It's not being about just playing nice.
Okay.
This is really about how to achieve what it is the United States wants, what's best for the United States. And I think that we're coming off this very traumatic in some ways 8-year period where the United States was isolated, it was isolating, we were antagonizing internationally in every way across the board. And so I think what you might be perceiving in an inchoate kind of sense is maybe a little bit of post-traumatic. So it's like, finally the U.S. can walk the halls of the United Nations and look people in the eye and sincerely, you know, say, you know, we're here to work with you, we're on your side, we're gonna move this forward. Of course, underneath it all is what's in it for the United States.
Let me ask you, I mean, one of the, like, major issues here at the, you know, certainly in the halls of the UN is Israel and the Palestinians. And I'll just say, just like to the just gut check here, it's not a good mood among the pro-Palestinian people. They're not at all happy with them.
No.
And they don't see it. I mean, maybe it's I'm trying to I don't even know if objectively you can say the policy. I mean, this is from, I'm saying from I literally want to say it objectively. Like, many people in the press corps and much of the General Assembly debates are always about that issue. There's a good deal of frustration of sort of where's the beef in terms of the Obama administration's position. And maybe people were just it was unrealistic. You know, they believed too much in this, like, you know.
I think it's just too soon. I just think there's so much to do and to get right.
Already got a Nobel Peace Prize.
But it's been a year.
Right.
I just feel
I didn't want to get sucked into it. I literally was like, I'm trying to think how this came about. I guess it was more, I'm sorry, I was trying to say, yes, they're playing nicer on the ICC, and then I had to reveal
okay.
that
okay,
on some issues,
there's
not a lot of
We're going
to
run out of time, and
nice.
There's these two other issues I do think we should talk about, which is, and I think it's interesting to kind of talk about them side by side. The Peter Galbraith story and the Tony Blair story. And I have to confess that on the Blair story, I mean, I've read mainstream media reporting on both of these.
Sure.
Tony Blair has a private sector deal with a cell phone company, which is operating now on the West Bank. Peter Galbraith, former U.S. diplomat, helper, drafter of the Iraqi Constitution, has a deal with it. It's a Danish oil company, right?
It's Norwegian.
Sorry,
each case,
I got my Scandinavian.
In each case, Jackie, it's more complicated than
it's
that.
It's way. I'm sure it's
no,
way.
No, no, and here's why. Because I hear in your tone of voice that maybe you think it's not.
I think it's complicated. I just wanted to kind of sketch out the framework of the two issues and then have you take it away.
Okay.
But I do think that the question to answer is, optically in both cases there's a problem, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I think probably more in Galbraith's case than in Tony Blair's mm-hmm. case. But I don't want to tell every diplomat, once you've been a diplomat, you can never go take a job, a real job with a, you know, real paycheck. Use your expertise for good in the private sector. So I just want to say that's my going in position. I'm not anti-business. I'm not anti-diplomat taking a step into the private sector. So anyway, that's my bias. Now in the Galbraith case, things don't look so good. I will offer.
I'll do Blair first, just because to me it's more of, it's a UN question in this sense. That there's no, the issue isn't that Tony Blair, when he left UK service, didn't, you know, shouldn't be allowed, as many US presidents do, to cash in. And Tony Blair did cash in. He's a $1 million-a-year consultant to JP Morgan Chase. He set up an advisory firm called Tony Blair Associates, which has Gulf Emirates as clients. That's all fine and good. The problem arises when he was named by the quartet, right, which is the UN, US, EU, and Russia, to be their envoy for economic development in the Palestinian occupied territories.
Okay.
Now
he's a
UN employee. He goes with a UN pass. He has a 10-room suite in the American Colony Hotel in Jerusalem that's paid for by UNDP.
Okay.
And he was sent. It's amazing that this is allowed. He was sent in his capacity as the UN/quartet representative. He negotiated with Israel about wave bands in the air for this new cell phone company that would do business in the West Bank. There's only one problem. The cell phone company's IPO was underwritten by JP Morgan Chase, which pays Tony Blair, and one of his Gulf clients has a 23% interest stake in the cell phone company. So in most places, here's what I'm saying. You're doing purportedly public work for a public organization in a way that provides financial benefit to your private employer. Maybe it's difficult to come up with rules where you can have part-time diplomats who part of the time
but
serve a private
employer. But that's effectively what these guys are. These guys are part-time diplomats.
I know, but I'm telling you, in any maybe I'm asking for too much. You have to recuse yourself. You have to, if you're going to serve two masters, it has to be made clear. And I think.
But wait, just so I'm clear, how was his UN? How was his quartet-related job relevant to the cell phone deal?
Oh, because the idea is that he's supposed to, that part of the reason that there'll be peace in that region is if there's more economic development.
Oh, okay.
So the cell phone
very
deal
vague.
Wasn't
that's
for a private conflict. Wasn't he, on paper, the cell phone deal was done as a public service operating as a UN official.
Okay, wait. Was the cell phone company did the cell phone company get its bandwidth or whatever it needed to start operating because the UN had anything to do with that?
Oh, absolutely. Tony Blair was, as UN envoy on economic development, was the negotiator. Tony Blair did not get paid by the cell phone company. He was working for the UN because this would be a good thing for economic development.
So he was wearing his UN hat. This is just so
he was wearing the UN hat, but in a way that benefited his private corporate masters.
Okay, so he was wearing, but the deal got done by him while he's wearing his UN hat?
Correct. In a way that benefited.
If that's the case, then that's totally unacceptable.
Right. And the idea is that they just sort of scoff at it and sort of say, well, they're lucky to have Tony Blair.
See, my understanding from reading this was that they were kind of two separate things. Yes, he's involved in economic development on the
work for that is, it's no, and the proof of the pudding is that, and it took me a while, but again, the UN just tried to run away from it. There was a meeting of something called the Ad Hoc Liaison Committee, which is the way they meet about the quartet, and Tony Blair, in a meeting with Ban Ki-moon, said, I am doing this for the cell phone thing in my UN capacity. Like, I was there for a number of briefings saying, like, will you confirm this was this for the UN or not for the UN? It was for the UN, and documents show that. So then the question, it became, you know, initially when this arose, when Tony Blair took the job, and that's true, people, you know, it was asked, could this be? Could there ever be a conflict of interest between, you know, your work, your payment by J.P. Morgan Chase, and your work in the West Bank? It was kind of like it's the same. There's another UN part-time diplomat, Alexander Downer, who used to be the foreign minister of Australia. He's the UN's guy on Cyprus. Meanwhile, he works for an investment bank based in Australia. So the idea is like, how are you going to make sure that in your work in Cyprus, it never intersects or benefits the investment bank? And he scoffed and said, oh, Cyprus doesn't have a lot of business. There's only one problem. The Cyprus conflict is really between Greece and Turkey, or certainly Turkey. And so if the investment bank you work for has a lot of Turkish business, anyway, it's ended up getting him in a lot of trouble in Cyprus. And I just, the whole thing seems to say...
I want to talk about the Galbraith thing because I think that poses perhaps equally now, a complex and troubling set of circumstances, you know, in ways that could really cause problems for the United States going forward in Iraq. So, in a nutshell, there's some litigation involved in this, right? In a nutshell,
Galbraith was, you know, serving there and was sort of something of a champion of the Kurdish people, and then
Galbraith was the guy who has consistently advocated a kind of loose partition, solution for the sectarian problem in Iraq,
correct?
And he has always supported sort of Kurdish control over their natural resources, and in the drafting of the constitution, supported provisions or recommended provisions that would give the Kurds financial control over future findings, right? Not, I think, the existing wells that goes into the big pot shared by the whole country, but future development that's for Kurdistan or something roughly along those lines.
No, totally. And basically, to cut to the chase, it emerged, and this gets bound up into the UN because of his service as the number two UN envoy in Afghanistan, as you'll see.
Yeah.
But while he was then serving the UN, it became, and this all credit for this has to go to Norwegian investigative journalists who were digging into a contract between a Norwegian oil firm, DMO, and the Kurdish regional government, and came across in the course of literally in terms of like getting to the bottom, there was an arbitration, and there was also, they came across a document showing Peter Galbraith seeking in an arbitration, assert his interest in he's claiming it's not an ownership interest, but a contract, but essentially an interest in a Kurdish oil field worth up to $100 million.
Yeah.
And so the idea is suddenly, obviously in Iraq, this is a huge thing where you say, like, how is this guy who was negotiating the constitution? I mean, that's why I would say the UN side of this, and this is where it's gotten kind of interesting, this information came out in the midst of the UN's own dispute with Galbraith about fraud in the Afghan election, right?
Right.
Galbraith was serving in Afghanistan. He went very public and said that the UN had sided with far too much with Karzai, and that the first round of elections were corrupt, and Kai Ida, his boss, the main envoy, was sort of corrupt himself. And literally, he was... Then the scandals came out in the Norwegian papers that, you know, Galbraith has his own problems. Galbraith was fired by the UN for having kind of breached protocol by criticizing his boss. And the issue arose, here was the kind of the interesting thing, is that the issue arose, you know, the did Galbraith, this was just the UN side of it. I'll just say that this is totally experientially. For some reason, I was trying to think of like, you know, there's nothing, you know, what new can be brought to this story? And suddenly it dawned on me, if it's not disputed, and it's not, that Galbraith has this interest in Kurdish oil, did he include it in his financial disclosure form to the UN that he had to fill out?
Fair question. Right. And so what's the answer
to that? So the answer is, he did fill out a form, but the UN is not going to disclose what's in the form.
Oh,
because that's
tricky.
Confidential.
Okay.
So I wrote that story, and I also, you know, tried to contact Galbraith. And lo and behold...
But by the way, isn't it correct, just before you go on, isn't it correct that his stake would amount to a 5% stake, because he's sharing it with this other Norwegian official, but isn't that now in dispute?
It is in dispute.
So he may walk away with nothing.
It's possible if he loses the arbitration at the same time as he does.
So
the fact that he had what his own belief of what it's worth makes it that he should never have been wearing those two hats. But I've yet to write the story, and so it'll be maybe I'll do it before this airs on Sunday, because I'm waiting to hear back from the Norwegian journalists. But Galbraith's claim, and I will, you know, to toot my horn, I wrote a first story and sent an email to Galbraith and just sort of like thought, well, he can respond or not. He has responded, and here's this position. His position is that he claims, disclose on his UN form this interest in Iraqi oil. And it's his further claim that the UN, Kai Ida, leaked this to the Norwegian press as a way to trash him. And I'm not really sure I believe it, because I've said, why don't you just release the forms you filed with the UN, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first, you know, the first leg of that argument is you have to show that you disclosed it to the UN. Then it would be a second thing to say that they improperly leaked it, and that would be kind of skeezy on their part. But he refuses to release the form. So, you know, just as on a sort of a gut check, like if you're saying you disclosed it, and you, and also, and the New York Times, believe it or not, has, because he used to write a lot of op-eds for them on the issue of Afghan election, they have now barred him from the op-ed pages.
Is that true?
They have. They did it in writing on the day, and they said because he failed to disclose the interest, no more op-eds from Peter Galbraith.
Wow.
So I think what I say is, if he didn't disclose it to the New York Times, why would he have disclosed it to the UN? But it's also weird that the UN and you know that these forms. What happens with these forms when they're filed? If no one can see them other than PricewaterhouseCoopers, who even defines what a conflict of interest is? Right? What if you wrote in and say, "Yeah, I actually have a secret stake in a company in the very country where I'm being an envoy to."
Well, we know Pricewaterhouse. They've
got a long name.
But they like don't have a particularly illustrious history of catching cheaters.
There you go. It takes one to know one, though, right?
Yeah, and no, I'm not suggesting that Pricewaterhouse but I'm just saying.
No, absolutely.
A couple of these pyramid schemes, we found out that PwC is behind some of the accounting that's supposedly gone on, and
Let's go full circle, Jackie. Why isn't the U.S. mission coming out in the light of these things with a reform proposal and saying, here's how the financial disclosure, ethics, and conflict of interest rules should work at the U.N. for the good of the U.N. so that it's not embroiled in sort of this sloppy business? Useful.
I'm not suggesting that wouldn't be useful. I mean, I still, in this case, we don't know all the facts, right?
Okay.
We don't know what he disclosed, what he didn't disclose. And frankly, we don't really know what his stake is going to amount to. As I was thinking about this, it would be useful to understand really what the timeline was, of his initial engagement with the company and his work in Iraq. It's all a little bit murky to me right now. And I think it, maybe this is something, if you tease this apart and find out that, it was this diabolical plot from the very beginning, my hunch is that it probably wasn't a diabolical plot. My hunch is that one thing led to another. He was in the right place at the right time. Maybe the company approached him. He saw an opportunity. His political views on the Kurds are probably very separate and apart from anything he was about to gain. So I'm prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt, but I also think that it doesn't look so good right now, barring more information.
All right, very fair. So I don't. Hopefully this. I don't know if your cell phone is still ringing, but I want to encourage you to.
I was just going to say, I'd like to encourage someone to call me up with an oil field.
That's what people here were saying. They're in the long line of business.
Come on.
My other holiday wish for you is don't watch depressing Christmas movies.
Okay. Do you have any?
I don't actually. I'm sorry. I don't. Maybe we'll think of some more upbeat ones, but not depressing. I didn't understand at first the reference.
Oh, my thing about you were that. No, yeah. But I love all those. I love Rudolph and Frosty and all. I mean, all that stuff is great. But actually, speaking of movies to see, Bob Wright's wife Lisa alerted me to this film that is having a showing at Princeton tomorrow, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It's called The Philosopher Kings.
Okay.
And it features the stories of 8 janitors that work at universities across the country, and I don't know all 8, but one of them featured is a Princeton janitor who's worked at the university for 15 years, and he also moonlights, I think, driving a taxi when he's not working, his full time job, and with the money that he earns, he not only supports his family back in Haiti, but he also has initiated several development projects in his father's village, which is apparently very remote and poor. And so this is a fascinating portrait of individuals who, with very few resources and no one paying attention to them and giving them any accolades for what they're doing, maybe until now, is doing something really meaningful in a small but important way. So I'm hoping to, in this holiday season, bring some or all of my children to this and maybe give them another idea about what they should be thinking about other than whatever latest Wii game, which I confess I like to play too.
Sure.
They're going to find under the tree.
No, that's great. That's we'll look for your review.
Yeah, so we'll put a link up to the Philosopher Kings. Excellent. I haven't seen it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, chilling out. I'm going to run to a Somalia briefing. But
all right,
sounds
great.
It's been exceedingly real.
All right. Thanks, Matthew.
Okay.
Take care.
See ya.
Bye.